Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 44 years. Every Sunday night at around 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and we chat with each other, we teach each other, we learn from each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you would like to reach Paul for SpaceNet reported stuff, he has an email address as well. It's spacenetreport@gmail.com. We offer a cut-and-paste list of interesting articles, YouTubes and such that we've seen throughout the week. I cut and paste it to a link page and offer it to everyone, and we keep it live for at least the next year. So if you go to your browser and type in roy.ac2gs.com, that will bring you to my link page. We offer you a chat room. Sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's busy. You get there by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. We offer an audio stream on the internet of this technical net, and we keep it live the rest of the week so that you can listen into the Glen Oaks repeater, even if you don't have a radio on you. You get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has over a million visitors, and it has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who have either moved out of the area through the years or, unfortunately, become silent keys. Their wisdom is still alive on those audio recordings, so keep that in mind. Let me drop, and we'll start the first segment of our little net. Okay, very often I start up the net with some new information about artificial intelligence. I think it's a very important field. It's going to make some dramatic changes to our lives and probably cause some dramatic changes to the economy in the next few years, so I figure it's as good a topic as any. This past week came to light two articles written by MIT. One, a much more learned one, kind of suggests what we've mentioned before, that businesses have invested a large amount of money and not been able to accrue any benefits from AI for the most part. Most business efforts have not really been able to be monetized. And the paper from MIT suggests that there's a lot of hype as part of the news and the buzz, and people are kind of creating an AI bubble, and bubbles almost always burst. And this one probably is no exception. So the MIT paper is very concerned about the AI bubble and the hype and everything, as am I. There's another paper from MIT which is a little bit older. It was written by an MIT doctoral student and suggested that his research into AI when it comes to material science is that it will revolutionize material science and heat up the economy as well. And two of his economics guys, you know, professors who he's doing his doctoral work under had their picture taken for this announcement of this paper. One of them is a Nobel Prize laureate, so very impressive people at MIT. Unfortunately, people started to look at the source material for the paper and found out that this doctoral student made it all up. He faked a large material science company. You know, he bought the domain, he supplied the numbers, and he made up his own numbers. So the bottom line is that paper will most likely be withdrawn from wherever it was sent, and this gentleman is no longer an MIT doctoral student. So be very, very wary of very, very good news. Figure where the money or the prestige is, and there's a lot of people who unfortunately are not the most moral people in the world. So that's my two stories about AI. I have a completely unrelated to AI story, which actually has to do with amateur radio. Many of you no doubt already have heard the news. There was a Japanese amateur radio convention where ICOM announced their new ICOM IC 7300 Mark II, much like they did apparently with the ICOM 706. They upgraded it to a Mark II, and it was very popular. So most likely the ICOM IC 7300 Mark II will be successful as well. They hinted that it should be released to sales by the end of 2025. It's very similar to the 7300 that you know and love. They've updated the receiver, so it has slightly better specs. They've improved the interfaces so that it has a USB.
What happened?
Like ABC to get. Yeah, well, that's a given. You'll always hear me. Will you hear me on Echo Link? I don't know. Anyway, we're all synced again. Unfortunately, I was blabbing a little bit too long, and I timed out the all-star connection, but everything resynced. So that's basically it. I mean, hopefully everyone got what I was saying. I mentioned the two MIT studies, which are interesting, and I mentioned the new ICOM IC 7300 Mark II, which is expected to be available the end of this year. So that's my little preliminary comment. As always, I'll ask people if they have any comments about this, and we'll go on to the questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask people to check in and give me their first name call sign, and if it's amateur radio related, to science and technology. And we'll take them in order unless we need to adjust it. Anyway, any comments about either my AI comments or about the new ICOM 7300 Mark II?
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich?
WS2N, your chat room is for some reason not operating right now. Back to you.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's open again. I don't know what closed it, but it closed itself. So, Rich, any comments about what I said?
Yeah, I have a comment on both areas. First of all, AI. As I said last week, I'm helping my daughter, who's in Israel, find a job, and I'm using AI to do it. Here's the prompt that I'm using. List 10 non-technical active job listings in Jerusalem. Include Tel Aviv if remote or hybrid. Require English and conversational Hebrew. List company, requirements, and descriptions. And I feed this to four different AI.
Mobile amateur radio club repeater system. No number.
It's just wondrous.
New England reflector.
The things that I'm getting. Do you know how long it would take me to go to each job board and put in these requirements and do the search? Where, especially Grok, by the way, for this application. I find Grok is the best one of all of them. It goes to each job board and searches under these requirements, and then comes up with, you know, with suggestions, and it's just wondrous. And all of the, so I send them to my daughter, and she applies for these jobs. They're all real. There's no hallucinations or anything like that. And it's just been wondrous. Let me let it drop. So that's AI. On the 7300 Mark II, luckily for me, I just bought a Mark 7300 about 7 months ago. So when I heard this Mark II is coming out, I said, oh my God, did I miss, you know, was my timing on that? But as they went through the list of what features it has, luckily for me, or I'd be beating myself up, I would miss 300, is they say the receiver has better performance. That I would like to have. I'd like to have better performance of the receiver. But all the remote stuff and the networking stuff and the HDMI and the USB, all that stuff I don't need. So I'm happy about that. Anyway, we'll see what the pricing is and when they're going to deliver it in the United States. Back to you, Roy.
KC2GS. Intents purposes, for your purposes, the only thing that you should be interested in is the slight improvement in the receiver, but it's not going to be a night or day change. It's just going to be a tweaking the and adjusting it to be a little bit better. But, you know, I mean, enjoy your own 7300. I'm sure it'll give you many years of pleasure, and it's still a very good design. And the Mark II won't be available at the very best until the end of the year, and it might take some further time. Who knows what the FCC will look by the end of the year. So yeah, I enjoy your present, your Mark I, if you will. As far as your AI, you know, I understand. You're very pro-AI, you're very pro-Grok in this particular case, and I'm happy for your abilities to use it and have productive episodes with it. I read just this week that Grok tends to be very expensive to run. It generates an excessive number of tokens, which is, you know, kind of that's kind of how they charge money, how many tokens you've used up, both in part of the input and part of the output. And Grok seems to be the most expensive per token, and it generates significantly more tokens than many of the other AI models. So, you know, some AI guys are not particularly thrilled with Grok. But I'm glad it's working for you. My bottom line is caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware, or let the user beware. All these AIs are still capable of hallucinating, and you don't know if it's hallucinating unless you know the subject, and usually everyone's asking subjects that they don't already know, so it's problematic. So we'll see how this drama unrolls. I still think there's a significant bubble, and most bubbles burst. So we'll see, and, you know, as the continuing weeks roll on, if I find interesting things about AI, I shall mention them, even if they're positive. I'm fine with positive ones, but I always like to offer a caution to everyone in this subject that's deeply overhyped. Even good old Sam Altman is starting to write articles about AI bubbles, so he must really be feeling itchy. Anyway, any other person with any comments on any of this subject? Okay, someone's very noisy, 100% noise, so if you can adjust things or turn things or point things in another direction, give it a try again. No, I'm sorry. Still 100% noise. I can't even guess who it might be. Anyway, you know, I would suggest you kind of look into your system, see if you could raise your power, see if you could move your antenna, or worse comes to worse, we still have EchoLink available, so you can go on to it and not have to worry about antenna problems. We'll go on to the next segment. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, preferably the early ones should be amateur radio related, but we'll accept any science and technology questions. So if you have anything, please feel free, hit that push to talk, give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio or science and technology.
FBC. KB2FYH.
ABCDU.
Okay, Rich, Alex, and KB2FYH. What's your first name, KB2FYH?
My name is Jim. Julius India Mike.
Okay, very good, Jim. Anyone want to help us here tonight?
Whatever it is breaking up.
Yeah, there's someone probably trying to get in who's all noise, unfortunately. Again, whoever it is who's trying to get in, you're 100% noise. I can't even guess who you might be. Again, try and do something. Either move the antenna around or raise the gain on the radio or consider using something like EchoLink. It's available on cell phones and personal computers, and our club's EchoLink connection is pretty good, so consider using that as well. So we'll give you another try. Anyone out there want to put their name on the list?
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Okay, Sam, you're on the list. Anyone else? Okay, we'll start now, and we'll give people an opportunity to ask more questions and comments and topics as the night progresses. Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
I'd like to ask the following. How critical is the length of coax used for an NFET half wave? And how do you figure out what's the best length to cut coax to? That's question number one.
Okay. Well, it sort of depends what you're using the transmission line for. If you're using the transmission line solely as a transmission line, in other words, if you have an RF choke at the feed point or some distance from the feed point, the length of the coax is immaterial. The only way that the transmission line affects the operation of an NFED is if you're using the transmission line's common mode as a counterpoise. So it depends upon whether you're choking it or you're not choking it. If you're choking it at some point, then you're not using the entire length as a counterpoise, and the distance of the coax is immaterial. The distance that you choke the coax is becomes important again, because that's the length of the counterpoise that you're operating with.
Okay, and how do you determine if you're choking it at the radio? How do you determine how long that coax should be?
Well, it's probably best to not do it that way, because if you don't do it that way, you can choke it at different lengths and keep the wire uncut, at least initially, and see how your antenna is operating. And if you happen to find a sweet spot of distance from the antenna feed point that you're choking it, that's the important length for the counterpoise. The rest of the length is up to you. It shouldn't have any significant effect unless it's terribly long and you have attenuation losses. So theoretically, you could move around the RF choke until you get the best type of performance, and then you could theoretically cut the end of the coax, you know, a foot away from the RF choke, or 10 feet or 20 feet. It shouldn't really make that much of a difference. It's more of a convenience factor than a performance concept.
Well, I have a 50-foot piece of coax, and I would hate to cut that. Well, how do you place an RF choke at different points for experimentation? I mean, you'd have to cut the coax at different points, right?
No, you could use a bunch of toroid snap ferrites and just, you know, put five or six in a row, and if you don't like that position, you can unsnap them and move them and snap them again. You know, it doesn't always have to be kind of connected to the RF choke. It could simply be a bunch of ferrites. I mean, you could also loop the transmission line around and around and have either an air core or a ferrite core a choke. But you could just as easily take, you know, five or six toroids that snap together and use that as a temporary test RF choke.
I thought those toroids were used more for electrical for noise rather than a choke.
Theoretically, if you want an effective choke, you use usually one of those toroids on things like microphone inputs and whatever to block RF. But if you want a reasonably good RF choke on a transmission line, you just put more than one toroid. You know, usually I've seen a type, I think it's W2DU. I'm not 100% that's the guy who made them famous. You can put about six or seven of those toroids in a row, and that will sufficiently block a good portion of your RF common mode.
Okay, what's the difference between that and a one-to-one choke?
Effectively, they serve the same purpose.
Okay. I'll see how it works out. I went out to try my first POTA activation today with a 23-foot length of coax, and my SWR was horrible. So, and then I came home, and I put a 50-foot length of coax on it, and my SWR, at least on 20 meters, was more tolerable. It was like about a 2.5 to 1, something like that. So I was disappointed, because it took a long time to go out there and set up the antenna, only to find that this 23-foot length of coax is not good for the NFED half-wave. So, all right, I will experiment with different lengths of coax and hopefully get a low SWR.
Nope.
My second thing isn't really, it's electronics, not necessarily ham radio. I replaced the radio in my daughter's vehicle, and I pulled it out, I saw that whoever did the radio work originally, and it was a replacement radio itself, so it wasn't a Ford, factory radio, but they put capacitors on each of the speaker wires, and I was wondering, what do capacitors do in an audio system like that? Is it for noise abatement? Because when I took them out, and when I wired in our new radio, there wasn't any noise, like from spark plugs or whatever. So what do you think they used? Why did they use those capacitors on the speakers?
I would assume they're using it to block direct current. So, there's a direct current bias in some amplification circuits, and loudspeakers don't really, they don't benefit from DC offsetting. They just move the diaphragm in constantly or out constantly. So he might have been using these capacitors to simply block any DC component getting to the speakers.
What does DC do to sound or amplification that he, whoever did it, felt that they needed to block it?
It may be a practice he always does. Like I said, usually your the cardboard, the diaphragm, the magnet, it's always in kind of the middle position when it's not powered. And if you supply alternating current or alternating voltage potential, the cone goes in and out and vibrates, and that causes the sound that you hear. Now, if you add an additional direct current voltage potential, it moves the diaphragm constantly. So it's not in the middle where it can have the most expansion and compression. It's now either stuck at the front of the loudspeaker, the cone is being pushed out, so you're only sort of getting half of the AC signal to cause any sound to be produced, or if the voltage potential is flipped 180, it's pressing up against the back of the diaphragm and causing the same slightly muffled output. You'll get the most audio output from an AC amplifier if you block any particular direct current bias that's as part of the signal that's going to the speakers, and you can do that rather easily with a capacitor. It blocks direct current, but it allows alternating current to go right through it.
So do they change the sound of the speakers?
They don't change the frequency much, but they do muffle the output. The dynamic range decreases if you're applying a DC bias in addition to the audio signal.
Why would somebody want to reduce the dynamic?
You don't want to reduce it. That's the point. You put in a coupling capacitor to remove any chance of a bias diminishing the dynamic range of the amplifier and the speaker.
Okay. But to the ears, what's the difference with putting a capacitor in or not using a capacitor?
If you don't have any DC current going in, it won't have any difference. If you do have DC current in the amplification stage and it's specced for requiring a coupling capacitor, then, as I said before, when you put the coupling capacitor in, you should get a purer sound with a better dynamic range than with a DC bias current always on your loudspeakers.
Okay, that I understand. Okay, that was my second question. The third, I know how resistors work, but why do we need them?
because for a bunch of different reasons. We've talked about RLC circuits, their timing circuits. Sometimes something as simple as a capacitor and a resistor will determine the time constant of this circuit. If you need something to happen at a certain time interval, a lot of times the output of one stage is stronger than you need for the next stage, so you use it to decrease the bias to transistors. You use it to decrease the amplitude of the previous stage. And, you know, there's a lot of little things where the levels that are required for optimal use of a circuit have to be kind of tweaked for a certain amount of either voltage difference, voltage potential. You have voltage dividers that are based on resistors, either a constant resistance or a variable resistor, so you can adjust the voltage on a certain input to a device. So there's a lot of different uses for resistors out there.
Do they usually have to do with states, you know, like after the stage or the circuit you're talking about? So, you know, what kind of current gets passed on to the next stage?
It's not what kind. The resistors don't have, you know, a alternating current and a direct current doesn't affect the resistor. Resistors do their resistance no matter what the frequency, you know, the frequency of the current could be zero in direct current or could be, you know, megahertz. It's unaffected by change in frequency. It's primarily to change the magnitude of voltage or limit the current.
Okay, but is it in relationship to another stage in the electronics? Why would a resistor, if you have a circuit that is the only circuit for the whatever component we're talking about, why would you need a resistor?
Again, it sort of depends on what you're using the resistor for. If you're using the resistor to lower the limit the current or lower the voltage from one stage to another, it's just because different devices operate optimally along different currents and voltages, and you know those are the specs for the circuit and for the component. If you're talking about within a component, there are a lot of times that you need to bias the base of your bipolar transistor. You have to get it to a certain voltage that's neither the positive or the negative real voltage. So this is a way of determining the optimum voltage potential through a divider, either based on fixed resistors or variable resistors. So it's used in a stage to bias your transistors. It's used between stages to limit current or limit voltage differences because of the design parameters of each stage going from one to the other.
Okay, well that's a good explanation for them. Those little pesky color-coded components. You know, I never really. I know basically what they're used for, but I never considered how many different uses that they have. I thought that, you know, resistors just limit voltage and that's it. But then, you know, I didn't take into account variable resistors. When do you need a variable resistor rather than, you know, just a resistor?
When the tolerances of the resistors are not defined and you need another way of tweaking and adjusting them. If you use fixed resistors, you're stuck with the value that they have. If you have a fixed resistor against a variable resistor, you can do a little tweaking. In the same way that you have a crystal that determines a resonant frequency, but very often you have a small trimmer capacitor that introduces a little bit of change to the resonant frequency. So variable components allow you to tweak them. Fixed components are kind of locked in.
Well, a volume control, for instance, is that a variable resistor?
Usually. I mean, unfortunately, nowadays, it's probably more likely to be an encoder that goes to a CPU device that does the audio scaling digitally.
I see that word coming up more and more and more, encoders. Encoders, what's the closest similar component to an encoder, I guess, in a non-digital circuit, it would be a variable resistor?
Not really. An encoder is just a way of sending a signal to the CPU. In the case of a volume knob encoder that's wired into the CPU, it has usually little optical detectors. It can then tell you, it has a series of lights and a series of optical detectors, and as you turn the knob, it flashes through the detector and it's able to tell what direction you're turning the knob and what velocity you're turning the knob and how many times you're turning the knob. So it tells the CPU that you want to change the volume for that particular encoder. You can have the encoder do anything in the CPU. It's just a way of it's a mechanical interface for the CPU. So depending upon what the knob is designed to do and wired into the CPU, it may change the amplitude of the signal. It may tune the FM broadcast frequency that you're receiving. It simply depends on the programming. The encoders are kind of all pretty much the same. There's slight variations in design, but it's an optomechanical device that translates your physical actions to commands to the CPU of the device.
Okay, which brings up my last question. How does it determine velocity?
It has a timer, and it knows when you're passing the little optical holes and lights and detectors. So the faster it's switched on and off, the faster that you're turning it, the velocity, angular velocity-wise.
Okay, so it's done optically. Okay. All right, I think that would be about to do it for FishNet, Roy.
Okay, very good, Rich. Thank you for your participation. I appreciate it. This is AC2GS. Jim, what do you got for us tonight?
That's coming back to me. My friend is a ham, and he had a heart attack over 2 weeks ago, and he has a big beam antenna on his roof, and he had a pacemaker installed, and he's worried about messing up the pacemaker if he pushes the button too far. Do I make sense?
Yeah, you make a lot of sense. I'll ask you a question. You may or may not know the answer, but I'll ask it nevertheless. Is it a demand pacemaker or is it just a vanilla pacemaker?
I can't answer that question. I would have to ask him about it. I asked Alexa about a linear amplifier and a pacemaker, she said it might mess it up, so to speak. She didn't use that language. But on the other hand, I've known this man many years, and he's a good ham radio operator, and he has a big beam antenna on top of his house, and when propagation is good, he goes all over the world. So he's sitting there at his table, and he's afraid to turn it on, because it just might mess it up and send them to the next world. Your opinion, please.
Yeah, well, again, it's extremely important what kind of a pacemaker it is. The early pacemakers and simple pacemakers don't have a big risk because they're just always on. You know, there's no signal that's going to change them. What's very common these days is what's called demand pacemakers, in which there are sensory devices around the pacemaker, and it's not always on. It's in standby mode, depending upon what his rhythm is like. If his rhythm is sensed by the pacemaker to be normal, it very likely would just sit there in standby and not do anything. Whereas, you know, if it says that he's skipping beats, it would go into demand mode and take over the pacing of his heart. Those are somewhat a lot more sensitive to outside radiation, you know, radio waves and such. And so you can kind of screw up the operations of a demand pacemaker. You know, you can sort of jam the demand pacemaker so that it stops in going into sense mode. It thinks it's always in sense mode. You know, it's always getting a signal. And so it can confuse the heck out of everything. I'm sure they gave him some literature on the subject. And at the very least, he should really contact the guy who placed the pacemaker in him and ask what kind of limitations he would suggest. You know, he might get away with a lower intensity. He may have to kind of park his linear for the time being. But I would first contact the guy's doctor just to double sure that this is a pacemaker that has issues with the local significantly strong RF field. I mean, it's something to seriously consider and look into. I wouldn't just turn it on and see what happens. So that would be my suggestion. Read the material that they most likely gave him, but if you can't figure out what it's saying, then contact that physician and ask them. But it's probably not the first time someone asked them that. I mean, there aren't that many amateur radio operators, unfortunately, but I think there's enough that guys who put pacemakers in for a significant number of years end up putting them in some amateur radio operators.
Thank you. I was thinking that if I could get an old dentist jacket when you took the x-rays and put it on him, and that might save him. But on the other hand, if he just pushed key down with less than 100 watts, you think he could get away with it? Over.
Well, number one, I wouldn't suggest the dentist shield. Dentist shields are for x-rays. You're not really worried about x-rays. You're worried about radio waves. And lead will kind of attenuate the signal a little bit, but again, we're not talking about x-rays. We're talking about radio waves. Is it possible that there's a certain amplitude signal by the way his antenna works that is less likely to affect them? Well, the lower the amplitude, probably yes, but I don't think at this point I would want to experiment. I mean, you might get away if you're lucky, because, you know, you might just, if it turns to the worst, it's probably not going to just blow up his pacemaker. It'll just kind of act erratically, and he'll feel a little strange, and hopefully if he turns off the RF signal, it'll go back to normal. But, again, I would still strongly advise to contact the doctor who placed it in him. He hopefully knows a lot about the particular electronics involved, whether it's a demand pacemaker or a non-demand pacemaker, and what the sensitivity issues might be for it. I hate to repeat myself, but I think that's the best solution. You don't want to really play Russian roulette with a pacemaker.
Thank you very much. So if I get the correct information from him, all the information, I come back to you next week, maybe you can give me an answer. Over.
Well, I can give you a rough approximation of an answer. Again, chances are there's going to be something lost in the translation. You know, you read a technical piece of paper, you relay it to you relay it to me, and we're playing, you know, either Chinese telephones or what have you, because there's something going to be lost in the translation along the line. So, I mean, you're more than, you know, it's fine by me. You can come back and give me some more information. But, again, I would probably still end up telling you, don't take any chances with this nonsense. You know, at least kind of get a sign-off from the cardiac surgeon that placed the pacemaker. Because, again, He's probably used the same model or very similar models for years, and he has a lot of experience of different people and their responses to it.
Eternally grateful for your knowledge, and thank you, and I'll come back to you next week or perhaps the following week. And thank you for everything. I learned so much about every time I get on this net, it's something new. I seldom do I speak or say anything, but I do learn a lot from what other people have to say, and I've been listening to this net for years, many years. And thank you. Good night.
Good night, Jim, and thank you. Thank you for participating. This is, once again, AC2GS, and next on our little list is Alex. What do you got tonight, Alex?
So I'm making a shortwave receive antenna and just, you know, putting it up with painter's tape all over the inside of my house. How is the thickness of the gauge of the wire affect the performance for receive? And also, if I'm making an MSET half wave, how do you choose which thickness to use? Is it always just better to go with the thicker if I have both options available? AD2D.
Okay. Ultimately, the thickness of an antenna wire determines how many watts you can put on it. You know, if you get a very, very, very thin piece of wire and you try to run, I know you're not going to, but if you try to run a kilowatt, chances are the wire is going to heat up in places at the peaks of current and just burn. So it's power handling capacity, and to a much, much lesser extent, the Q decreases as you make the conductor thicker. Where it's demonstrated a significant change is when people build little cages, box antennas, where the sides of the of multiple elements of wires are at such a smaller than the wavelength of the frequency of RF you're using, that the antenna acts as though it's a solid box of conductor, and so that gives you a decreased Q. And a decreased Q gives you a broader bandwidth. So theoretically, if you take an antenna that has a bandwidth of, say, 200 kilowatts wide before it starts to lose resonance and to develop imaginary impedances, and you make it thicker, then it'll have a wider bandwidth before it starts to attenuate the signal. I hope that explains that.
So does that mean that basically, if I'm for just into a shortwave radio, that the length of the antenna would matter less, like it being tuned exactly somewhere, if I use the thicker wire? And also, just if it's just received, like if I'm doing an MFET half-wave, I'm going to follow someone's instructions and cut it exactly. If it's for received, can I just string up as much of it as I can and get away without measuring it?
The short version answer is yeah. Fortunately, receivers are much less picky than transmitters. Even if you have an impedance mismatch, you know, the front end of receivers are designed to operate in the microvolt range, so you probably still have enough energy to kind of trigger the first stage of a receiver's multi-stage system. So it's less important that you have resonance for a receiving antenna than a transmitting antenna, which if you don't have proper resonance, you'll get reflections back into the transmitter. If it's protected, it'll cut back the output power and limit your abilities. If it's an old one that doesn't have protection circuits, it could burn out the final transmitter, so that's not good either. So, yeah, theoretically, if you're going to make a half-wave NFED legitimately half-wave NFED. You should kind of make it for the longest half-wave that you can. You know, if you can make it 40 meters for 80, or even 80 for 160, you should try and do that. But if you're not exactly on frequency, you won't get quite the amplitude in the signal, but most receivers can still deal with it for most cases.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. The painter's tape thing doesn't make me... It's not aesthetically pleasing, but it let me experiment a little bit. Thank you for the help, Roy. Very informative.
You're welcome, Alex. I wish you good luck, and come back and tell us how it worked out. Okay, on to Sam. Sam, AE2YG. How you doing, and what can I do for? Sam, are you out there? Okay, I guess Sam stepped away for a little bit. He'll probably come back soon. Anyone with any questions, comments, or topics for tonight, please hit that push to talk.
Good evening, Roy.
Good evening, Sam.
I'm just listening this evening.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood. Okay, very good, Sam. Once again, this is AC2GS, so we got a bunch of time left, so hopefully we'll have a couple of good, interesting topics and or questions. If anyone has anything on their mind, please hit that push to talk and put your name on the list.
And one whitey white.
Yes, Hank. How you doing there? What can I do you for?
I'm just wondering if anyone knows anyone who can repair radios. I have a couple that don't work, one of which I have a suspected reason, and the other I have no clue why it doesn't work, and don't really have either the time or the skill myself to do these things. So I was wondering if anybody knows anyone who does repair radios at this time.
What brand of radio are you looking to have fixed?
I've got two Yaesu FTM-10 radios that need to have a filter replaced, and I have a TNC that doesn't seem to work right, and I have no idea why it doesn't work. It's the KPC-3.
Okay, offhand, I don't know any guy who fixes Yaesus these days. George, KD2FIU, knew a guy who fixes ICOMs, and he checked out Sam's ICOM a couple months ago or two. Anyone out there have any good ideas of people who fix Yaesu radios these days? I don't think so. Sorry, Hank. I would suggest, again, a month or so ago, George came by and offered a contact for Sam about ICOM. Maybe he has other contacts. So I would suggest that you email George and give him a holler and ask him. Maybe he knows someone.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much. And one whitey way.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Hank. Once again, I'm still AC2GS here, and still got lots of time, so if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, hit that push to talk, and let me hear it.
AD2DU?
Yeah, Alex?
window pass-through is delivered, those little things you shove the window in, I don't know the best way to get my coax outside the house without having to have someone come and adjust to the alarm system. Would you put a choke on either side of those, or are there any best practices to using them? They seem like something that's going to lose some of the signal. It's like, they're not brand name, whatever. ADCDU.
Okay, I think what you're alluding to is there are these little segments of flattened transmission line, and the idea is that it usually has a UHF connector on both sides, and you insert it between jumpers and such, and you close your windowsill on the flat portion of that transmission line. Is that what you're alluding to?
Yeah, exactly what I'm talking about. Are those functional for transmitting 100 watts through?
Yeah, 100 watts, fine. I don't know if I exactly recommend regularly you use a kilowatt full duty transmission through them, but 100 watts it should suffice if they're well designed, unless they're faulty, in which anything that's faulty is not going to work right. But it shouldn't give you any problem. You shouldn't really need to RF choke them for their own sake. But I mean, if you're going to apply an RF choke before you get it into your house, that's always a good idea. It limits to a degree the amount of RF that gets into your shack, and so there's still usually some sensitive equipment, usually a computer, that can hiccup with too much RF in your shack. But it's not particularly inherently necessary due to the fact that you're using one of those thin transmission line jumpers.
I mean, does everyone just drill a hole through the wall of their house and build a junction box or something? Or is there some other way to do this that I'm missing?
No, I mean, pretty much you got two options. Either you make your own or you buy, if they still have them, MFJs. Basically, it's a plank of wood with some metal covers on either side, and they have holes in the wood, so you run the transmission line through a 2x4 section, and then close your window on top of that, and you have the problem with the burglar alarm system. Or the other option that a lot of guys do is you get yourself one of those long drill bits, and you just drill it out outside, and you just make a hole. I mean, telephone companies do this all the time. If you have any telephone connections, you most likely have those holes already in your wall. Usually the telephone guys put it at the baseboard where the molding is. But, they're there if you have telephone wires, unless you've gone totally wireless.
That's helpful, thank you. I'm still a little shy to start drilling holes in the wall, but I may get there eventually. We'll see. Thank you for the info.
You're welcome. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Limewire Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussions or comments, feel free to hit that push to talk.
Speaking to ENR with a query.
Certainly.
So, forgive me, this is probably an elementary or tier one question here, so hopefully it's at some level interesting and not redundant, but I am curious if there is a whole lot of propagation differences between the 2 meter and 70 and the 70 sector bands when broadcasting. I know you're not going to be going particularly crazy in distance wise, but I'm curious if there is any meaningful amount of difference between the two when trying to do any level of distance, even if it's over several miles or something to that effect.
point to point when it comes to 70 centimeters. You know, there's no refraction to 2 meters as well. 2 meters has some events, you know, ductal inversions. We'll produce.